Hi, I'm Susan Swain, host of C-SPAN's Q&A, where we spend an hour with nonfiction writers and historians who add context to today's news. In 1997, upon the expiration of a 99-year negotiated lease, sovereignty over Hong Kong passed from the United Kingdom to the People's Republic of China. Large demonstrations of sometimes more than a million people opposing China's authority began in 2003, culminating in the violent 2019 protests and subsequent crackdowns by the Chinese government that made headlines around the world. In this week's episode, you'll meet Louisa Lim, author of a new book titled Indelible City, Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong. Lim grew up in Hong Kong and covered Hong Kong and China as a reporter for the BBC and NPR. She discusses the history of British rule in Hong Kong and describes what life has been like for Hong Kong residents since the 1997 handover.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
I should like, on behalf of Her Majesty the Queen and of the entire British people, to express our thanks, admiration, affection, and good wishes to all the people of Hong Kong. We shall watch with the closest interest as you embark on this new era of your remarkable history.
Countdown in Shanghai.
Louisa Lim, that's from the C-SPAN archives, video of the 1997 ceremony marking the handover of Hong Kong from Britain to China. You've just published a book about Hong Kong titled Indelible City, and you write that the past 25 years since that handover, the city I call home has changed irrevocably. In what ways?
Oh, it's changed in so many ways. So when Hong Kong was handed back to China in 1997, there was an agreement that was struck, and China was supposed to preserve Hong Kong's way of life without change for 50 years. So that includes things like, when Hong Kong was handed back in 1997, it had a relatively free press. People could protest. There was freedom of expression, freedom of religious belief, freedom of association. And in the last couple of years, China has brought in this national security legislation, and that has really changed all of these things. You know, newspapers have been shut down, civil society organizations have been disbanded. Marches, protests have been forbidden. Now, that originally happened because of COVID, but, all the kind of really the things that made Hong Kong, Hong Kong, one by one, that they're kind of being dismantled. And, you know, it's particularly the case in politics where the legislature has been completely remade. Politicians, democratic politicians, have been placed in jail, 47 of them awaiting trial under this national security legislation, after they just tried to have primary polls to decide who should stand in election. So the new legislature, the electoral system, has been remade patriots only. I mean, you know, it's really a sort of top to bottom reshaping of an entire society.
Tell me the story you want readers to know in Indelible City.
There's so many stories of Hong Kong, and I think that's one of the things that I want to get across, that this is a place that used to be a British colony. It's a place with its very own distinct history. And it's a place about which there are many stories, not just one kind of top-down story of the kind that China likes to tell. I mean, Hong Kong is a complicated place, and it's a place of many different stories and many different narratives. But it's also, I think, perhaps most importantly, one of the things that I wanted to get across is that the voices of Hong Kong people have really been lost from their history, because it was handed from one sovereign power, the British, to another, the Chinese. Its history has always been written for it by those sovereign powers. And I wanted to do something different. I wanted to write a history of Hong Kong that really centers Hong Kong voices, that really includes Hong Kong people. And when I started writing it, I went to see a historian called Tim Koh. And we were talking about the history books that existed, and he said, you know, the problem with Hong Kong's history books are there are no Chinese names, no faces of Chinese people. And when I thought about it, you know, this was so true, even in that handover ceremony that you heard, no Hong Kong people spoke at the most important moment of their entire lives. So I wanted to go some way to rectifying that.
You do tell a sweep of Hong Kong's history in your book, but in terms of the current situation, you included an author's note at the outset of the book, and in the acknowledgments you describe about writing a book that terrifies me. Can you tell me more about the concerns you have in publishing?
Yeah, it was a hard book to write, and one of the reasons was that national security legislation that was imposed on Hong Kong in June 2020, and it outlaws secession, sedition, terrorism, and collusion with foreign powers. But these offenses are really not well defined. They're very broad, they're very vague. People have been arrested for things like having banners or stickers with very popular protest slogans, you know, slogans that millions of people were shouting in 2019. And so the cost of violating these national security laws is very, very high, but nobody really knows what they are. You know, as people say, there are no red lines in Hong Kong anymore. It's just kind of a red sea because there are red lines everywhere and nobody really knows where they are. And that made it really hard for me in writing the book because, you know, I had been doing interviews for, you know, since 2014. I had this whole archive of interviews. And although the national security legislation is not supposed to be retroactive, it has been employed retroactively. So it was really hard to know, you know, whether I should use people's names or not, whether I should quote things that they had said sort of back in 2015, you know, years before this legislation had been passed, whether that could in some way come back to damage them or be dangerous for them. And, you know, even though I had wanted to write a book that centered Hong Kong voices, I ended up having to remove a lot of those names and of those faces that I wanted to include because I just didn't know whether it was safe. And, you know, there was no one who was able to tell me because there was no precedent for this kind of very draconian law. So there were lots of, you know, quite tricky decisions about what to include and what not to include. And, you know, for me, that was really hard because I wanted to include as many Hong Kong voices as possible, yet at the same time, I didn't want to put anyone at risk.
You are talking to us from Melbourne, Australia. When is the last time you were in Hong Kong?
I was last in Hong Kong in January 2020, just before COVID hit, and before the national security legislation was passed.
And how many years did you live in Hong Kong?
I grew up in Hong Kong, so my parents moved there when I was a very small child. And so I grew up there, and then I worked as a journalist there. When I was just starting out in journalism, I covered the handover of Hong Kong as a very young journalist working for a local television station. And I kept going back. I was a reporter in Beijing, first for the BBC and then for NPR for 10 years. And in that capacity, I also kept going back. So, you know, I've had a very long relationship with Hong Kong, and I've, you know, seen it as home for my life. All of my life.
Throughout the book, you write about your struggles with the need to have journalistic impartiality and also being so closely attached to this story. And in fact, the descriptions of it is that it's an intensely personal look at Hong Kong. How did you end up reconciling that tension between journalism and being involved?
Yeah, it was a very difficult balance for me. As a journalist who has really been trained in that very long sort of BBC tradition of impartiality and neutrality and sort of writing these pieces where the journalist is kind of suspended out of the action, you know, we used to call them stand back pieces. I found it very hard to do that once the protests broke out in Hong Kong. One of the reasons that I didn't want to practice that kind of journalism was that constant need for balance, for quoting government officials. I was seeing this every day in the local press, even though the comments the government officials were making were often completely false, you know. They were assertions such as calling protesters rioters when I had been on the streets and I knew there had been no riots. Or, you know, comments, for example, when they overhauled the electoral system and they put in place these new regulations saying only patriots could run for election. And, you know, there many politicians were put in, were arrested under the National Security Act, and you know, government officials were saying that democracy was being improved. I mean, when these kind of statements were constantly being repeated by the local media without any kind of fact checking or any kind of clarification, you know, I just felt it wasn't in the service of accuracy and truth. It wasn't reflecting what was happening on the ground. And I didn't want to practice that kind of journalism where falsehoods were constantly being repeated. You know, I think the analogy would be now if every time you wrote a story on Ukraine, every story you quoted a Russian government official, that's the kind of treatment that was happening in the local media in Hong Kong, because it's, you know, very much owned by businessmen with interests in mainland China. And I just decided that was not the kind of journalism I wanted to practice.
You've twice used the term patriots. What does it mean in Hong Kong today?
What does it mean depends on who is defining it. China uses the term patriots to talk about people who love China and who their view of patriotism is not just loving China, but loving China's Communist Party and supporting it. And so, you know, it's very, very much shorthand for people who are loyal to Beijing. In China's view, patriots sort of does not refer to people who are in the pro-democratic camp. You know, those politicians sort of with deep roots in Hong Kong who have run in competitive elections in Hong Kong, you know, for decades, in China's view, they might not qualify as patriots, even though they have, you know, grown up in Hong Kong and really... you know, served the people of Hong Kong through, you know, elections, but China, in its new system, it requires that those people who want to stand for election be vetted by a committee which is headed by the head of security and national security police. And so police allowed to decide if people are patriotic or not. You know, it is a national security era in Hong Kong. National security trumps everything.
How many people live in Hong Kong today?
It's about 7.5 million.
And are there any reliable measures of the population's attitudes towards the current government?
The most reliable measures would have been the last elections that happened that were free and fair. So those would have been the district council elections that happened towards the end of 2019, where politicians were allowed, you know, it was before the national security legislation passed, and it was during this, during, in the period when Hong Kong was still having a lot of protests, street protests. And it was a really interesting indicator of what public sentiment was. For a long time, the government had argued that there was this silent majority that supported the government, that supported, you know, Beijing's point of view. And then when this issue was put to the people of Hong Kong, when they were allowed to vote for whoever they liked, it turned out there was a silent majority, but it did not support the government. It overwhelmingly supported the pro-democratic forces, the pan-democrats, as they're called, so a camp of democratic parties. And what happened was that they won a landslide. So all of the district councils, I think except one, turned from being pro-Beijing to being pro-democratic. And, you know, it was a complete reversal of the previous results, and it showed that if given a vote at that point in time, the population did not support the government. I think now, you know, it wouldn't be possible to have that kind of election because most of those candidates who were successful, many of them have been thrown off district councils. You know, dozens have been put in prison or are awaiting trial. Some of them have fled. You know, you couldn't have a free and fair election of the same kind anymore.
Nor a reliable poll, it sounds like, public opinion poll.
Nor a reliable poll. I mean, you know, just to give you an idea of how difficult it is to measure public opinion, the polling company, which is best known for having over the past few decades run polls, their head pollster just fled about 2 weeks ago. And he fled Hong Kong saying that he had been the subject of so much intimidation that he was unable to continue in his position anymore. And, you know, bear in mind, this is not a politician. It's someone who does polling. So, you know, if you look at the inferences that you can draw from that, it is that, you know, the government is so, it doesn't want necessarily to know exactly what the people are saying because maybe the people don't agree with it.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
There were two stories recently in the news as I was reading your book that I wanted to get your perspectives on. The first was the election of John Lee as Hong Kong's new leader.
Yeah, so John Lee is a former security official, and his choice as Hong Kong's new leader is very interesting, and the way in which he's chosen is also very significant. You know, it was called an election, but there was only one candidate. So it wasn't an election, it was a selection. And the fact is that Hong Kong's leader, the chief executive, has generally been someone with a civil service background. In his case, he doesn't have a civil service background. His background is in the security forces. He's a former policeman. He rose up through the ranks, and, you know, he was the security official in charge of suppressing the protests in 2019. So, you know, he's an enforcer figure who's been chosen for his loyalty, really, to do Beijing's wishes. And, you know, even the kind of the details that emerged about him during the run-up to his selection were interesting. You know, that all the local reporters, even those in the sort of pro-Beijing press, were trying to write profiles of him. And, you know, the one detail that really stuck in my mind was that his former colleague said he wasn't a very pleasant person, and he used to eat lunch sandwiches at his desk by himself. He's not a particularly convivial choice, but he is someone chosen for his loyalty and his ability to do what Beijing wants him to do in Hong Kong.
The other news story that caught my attention, I wanted to get your comment on, was the arrest of 90-year-old retired Catholic Cardinal Joseph Zen and three others for their work in a now-defunct organization that aided protesters. Cardinal Zen was one of the people that you interviewed for your book. What was your reaction to his arrest and what it means?
Honestly, this was a very, very shocking moment for any Hong Konger, because Cardinal Zen is so widely known in Hong Kong. Regardless of your religious background, he's just known as a sort of very upstanding, very moral figure who has for decades stood up for his beliefs and really stood up for Hong Kong people. He's widely known as being sort of staunchly pro-democratic. You know, he attended a lot of the marches and the rallies in 2019. And he's a very popular figure. He's extremely outspoken. I interviewed him for my book. And, you know, even back then in 2019, when the protests had first started, you know, he had extremely strong opinions about what it meant and what it meant about Hong Kong's direction of travel. And he was extremely pessimistic, you know, even a couple of weeks into the protest. And I'm sorry to say that his worst fears have been realized. I think his arrest is a very shocking moment because, you know, he's a cardinal, he's 90 years old, and he's so very highly respected, and the other people who were arrested with him are also highly respected figures, sort of pillars of society. One of them, Margaret Ng, is the former legislator representing the legal sector. She's a lawyer and a constitutional law expert, and yet she too has been arrested for being a trustee in this fund that was helping the families of people who were being prosecuted for protesting. So, you know, I think it's a real sign for Hong Kongers, these arrests, that, you know, the gloves are off, that anyone is fair game and that nobody is protected, sort of no matter what your status is and how elderly or respected you might be. And I think many Hong Kongers also read it as a sign that one of Beijing's aims is to take aim at Hong Kong's civil society by going after those people who are kind of pillars of civil society, like religious leaders. So, it's not yet clear exactly what the charges will be against them, but even the act of arresting them and interrogating them and then releasing them is enough to send real chills across all of Hong Kong.
In Indelible City, you said that China reported on its endgame for Hong Kong, or outlined it as far back as 2016, and in fact that the planning for it has been underway for decades. What is that endgame? What does it look like?
Well, China's endgame for Hong Kong is that Hong Kong should be just another Chinese city, like any other major city, like Zhuhai or Guangzhou or Shenzhen. These are all major urban conglomerations along China's southern coast. And China would like Hong Kong to be another city like them. It calls these cities the Greater Bay Area. And its end game is that Hong Kong is to be folded into that Greater Bay Area. It would like Hong Kong to be quiet, to be docile, to be loyal, and, you know, not, I think, to have any particularly special status.
Hong Kong has for centuries been a global trading center, merging East and West. What does it mean for the many businesses, the Western businesses that have been in Hong Kong today as these developments unfold?
Well, the trading businesses that are in Hong Kong now are leaving, and they're leaving in their numbers. And I mean, there were several different factors that are contributing to that. One is certainly the collapse of the rule of law. In the past, Western companies have liked to be being in Hong Kong because it offered a predictability. It offered a very stable legal environment with rule of law that you might not necessarily see in China, and a real lack of corruption. And I think the national security legislation removes that kind of legal predictability, and it heightens the risk. So that's one reason. Another reason that Western companies are leaving Hong Kong is that Hong Kong is following China's zero COVID policy. And there were very strict regulations to try and stop the spread of COVID. Quarantine in hotels for arrivals, you know, quite long periods of quarantine. In the past, people with COVID and close contacts have been sent to quarantine, and that has been very draconian, with parents being separated from their children and people having to spend long periods of time in quarantine camps. And all of this is spooking Western companies and Western businessmen and leading them to leave. And, you know, particularly the fact, I think, that there's no, at the moment, no exit out of this zero COVID policy that's visible.
Well, while we're
so I think all of these factors.
While we're talking about comings and goings, especially right now post-COVID, but people who live in Hong Kong have a Chinese passport, is that correct?
People who live in Hong Kong have an SAR passport, so it's a passport for Hong Kong Special Administrative Region.
What can people come and go as they wish from Hong Kong, COVID restrictions aside? Let's just say if one wanted to move elsewhere in the world, could they do that?
It's hard at the moment to to say COVID restrictions aside, because what COVID restrictions have done in Hong Kong have been to cut down the number of international flights coming into and leaving Hong Kong. So in many cases, even if you wanted to leave, there was literally no way out. You know, there were sometimes no flights, for example, between, I think, Hong Kong and the UK at the moment, there were no flights. So in many ways, the problem isn't necessarily even the passport, but the passport itself can be problematic as well.
So I want to go back in history, which you do in your book, and understand the 100 years before the handover. You tell us that Hong Kong was ceded to the British in 1841 as one of the spoils of the Opium Wars. Why did the British want an outpost there?
The British wanted a trading city. They wanted what would become a great emporium of trade in the East. And so they decided that Hong Kong would suit this purpose. You know, at the time, Britain's focus was trying to rebalance its trade deficit with China, and to do that through selling opium into China. Opium was banned. It was not legal in China. But the British had this, you know, tremendous trade in opium, and they wanted a free port in order to run that business. So Hong Kong served that purpose for them. And, you know, the British built it into this, you know, international center of finance.
In researching your book, you went back into the British archives and looked at the documents surrounding the negotiations and ultimately the 99-year lease. What was the thinking between the two parties in granting a lease of this sort?
So the 99-year lease was for the new territories. So Hong Kong, the sort of three parts of land that make up Hong Kong. Hong Kong, which was ceded in perpetuity in 1840, Kowloon, which was ceded in the 1860s, and then the New Territories, which is a much bigger portion of land that was given on a 99-year lease to Great Britain in 1898. And at the time, China didn't want to cede any more land because it was under pressure from Western powers to give portions of land to them as concessions, and it didn't want to do that, didn't want to lose any more territory. So that was why it wanted a lease. From the British point of view, you know, to be honest, it just seemed like the British were very sloppy with their thinking. The man who was in charge of negotiating that lease, Claude MacDonald, he didn't even have an up-to-date map of Hong Kong when he was doing his negotiations. It's believed that he wasn't even really aware that a 99-year lease was a lease. You know, it's thought that he thought that this might be given in perpetuity. And, you know, I think the British weren't really thinking forward. They just assumed that China was weak and could be bullied and wouldn't want, you know, this land back. I don't think the British were that concerned about Hong Kong's residents or what would become of them. And so, you know, this problem, what would happen to the people of Hong Kong, that was really kicked down the road for, you know, decades and decades.
For people of Hong Kong, such as yourself, who are older than 25 and knew life under the British, what was it like?
I mean, life under the British was not by any means perfect. You know, the British had decades to introduce democracy to Hong Kong, and they hadn't done that. They feared the loss of control. They thought it might be hard to get Hong Kongers to do what they wanted, so they didn't introduce true democracy or widen the franchise really at all until the last possible moment. Life under the British was, you know, there was legal predictability, but no democracy. Hong Kong at the time was growing very fast, and the British were responsible for building these new towns, for providing sort of accommodation and schooling, building up a civil service, a police force, and that kind of measure of predictability. So it was a place which really changed from being somewhere that people passed through on their way to somewhere else, to a place that really became home for generations of people. And that was really the big change that happened under the British.
You write in your book that the British really didn't pay attention to the impending 1997 date until 1982 under the Thatcher government, and then ramped up the negotiations with then Chinese Premier Deng Xiaoping. But what leverage really did the British have legally?
I mean, it's, you know, it's a difficult question to answer. The British always believed that they had a very weak hand. They knew that Hong Kong was to return to China in 1997. And when they had gone to negotiate over its future, Deng Xiaoping had actually said to Margaret Thatcher, we could take Hong Kong back tomorrow, but we have not done that. So that was, you know, a threat. And I think those words were really present in the minds of British governors and British officials, you know, at the forefront of their minds as they then negotiated Hong Kong's future. I think, though, you know, that threat, that idea that China could go in at any moment, was something that made them believe that they had a very weak hand. And so if you read the documents, you know, I found this really interesting tranche of documents, interviews with senior Hong Kongers who had been advisors to the British, that had really sat on this library shelf for decades. These were interviews done by a Hong Kong political scientist called Steve Zhang in the 1980s and 1990s. And the agreement was they were to be held for 30 years from the last incidents described in them before they were to be released. So by the time they were released, many of the people who had been interviewed had already died. And, you know, that was what made them so interesting to me, because these were people who weren't able to speak during their lifetimes because they'd signed the Official Secrets Act and they were bound to silence. And this had really been their only chance to say what they really thought. And they'd sort of really unburdened themselves. The interviews that they gave were sort of so anguished, and they were so disheartened by the negotiations and the British attitude, and they were so worried about the future. And the warnings that they gave were so prescient. You know, the things, the problems that we see today are problems that they foretold back in the 1980s and 1990s, and the British didn't listen then. So, you know, for me, it was a really stunning and sort of actually very sad discovery to read these documents and find out, you know, just what had happened behind the scenes.
Well, on that note, you talk about the very last British governor, Patton, then that you interviewed him. And it was a really compelling scene that you described in his book when you asked him his reaction to what had happened there. What did he say to you?
Yeah, it was a really interesting moment. So I interviewed him in 2019, and it was while the protests were happening in Hong Kong. And he was visiting in Melbourne, and I had just come back from Hong Kong. And while I was in Hong Kong, I'd been at a protest, and I'd seen on the wall, by that point, there was a lot of anti-China graffiti or graffiti being sprayed all over the city. And on the wall, sprayed on a subway wall, the wall of a subway station, I saw someone had spray painted his words, the words that he had said during the handover ceremony in 1997. I can actually read them out for you. They were the words that he'd said during the handover ceremony. "Now Hong Kong people are to run Hong Kong. That is the promise, and that is the unshakable destiny." So when I saw those words on the subway wall, I was really, you know, I was struck by how far we had moved from that moment. And when I interviewed him, I wanted to ask him about that. I wanted to ask him for his views on those words. And, you know, all the years that I had watched him, I know just what a talented politician he is. You know, it's quite difficult to get him to really, you know, as a politician, it's quite hard to get him to sort of really sometime, you know, to really admit to anything or, you know, to show emotion sometimes. And I had a certain amount of time, half an hour with him, and eventually I thought I would ask him about it. So I showed him the photograph on the phone, and I said, "Oh, I don't know if you can read it, but these are the words that are written on the wall." And I read them out to him. Oh, and I said, how does it make you feel seeing those words?" And suddenly he just stopped talking. Until then, he'd been so fluent. And he was completely silent. And then he said, "Bad, bad, bad, bad." And he bowed down so his head was almost on the table. And it was a gesture that I had seen him make at the handover ceremony in 1997, at a moment that I knew he was overcome with emotion because he'd written about it in his book, in his autobiography. It was the moment that there was this piece of music by Edward Elgar that played, and he wrote about how it undid him. And he made exactly the same movement, the same gesture when I interviewed him. And it really recalled that moment for me.
Louise Lam, you reminded us that the Chinese promised in 1997 50 years of one country, two systems. And you tell us in the book that for the first 5 years, essentially, things were pretty unchanged. But starting in 2003, and I should tell you, we have about 20 minutes left in our hour together, the protests began and started peaceful and then became bigger and ultimately more violent. Walk us through the stages of changes in society and the protests that erupted, that people can understand the progression.
So in 2003 were the really first massive protests. And at that time, 500,000 people took to the streets out of a population of about 6 million. So it was a significant proportion of the population. And at that time, those protests were against something which was known as Article 23. So it was an attempt by the government to bring in legislation that outlawed secession and subversion. And people didn't want it. People were scared of it. People believed that it would undermine the legal system. And that many people came out to protest, and the government withdrew its proposals. So I think this was a real turning point for Hong Kong, as they saw that if enough people took to the streets, they could influence the government in a way that it was very hard to do through the legislature, because the way the legislature was set up always prioritize pro-government forces. So I think people knew that street protests could change things. And over the years, we saw growing street protests. So at first, they were relatively small and often about sort of preservationist issues. You know, there was a protest when the government tried when the government demolished a pier called Queen's Pier. There were activists that occupied the pier and handcuffed themselves to the pier. And they lost that fight. That was knocked down. But there were a number of other quite small protests about preservationist issues. And then in 2011, there were very big protests about national and moral education. So this attempt by the government to bring in sort of Chinese-style, almost propaganda-like education in the schools. And that time it was school children who came out, you know, tens of thousands of young people surrounded the government building and demanded that that not happen. So that, again, that proposal was withdrawn. Then in 2014, it was the Umbrella Movement, where, again, very large numbers of people took to the streets and occupied some of the major streets for 11 weeks, asking for more democracy. And that time, that was unsuccessful. They got no concessions at all from the government. But those were very large protests. Up to 1.2 million people took part. And then in 2019, you know, everything erupted. And we, when the government tried to bring in this anti-extradition bill, and those protests soon turned also into sort of pro-democracy protests, and they were huge. So 2 million people out of 7.5 million.
2014 seemed, from reading your book, was a real tipping point, because the police began for the first time to use tear gas to control the crowds. And here's a statistic that's an eye-popper. You said that by the end of 2019, 90% of the people of Hong Kong had experienced tear gas.
So there was tear gas used in areas where 90% of the population lived. And, you know, it was extraordinary, you know, the stories that you heard. You know, there were people in old people's homes who were being tear gassed as they sat in their living rooms, because Hong Kong is so densely populated that tear gas on the street was just rising and leaching through the window frames. You know, people were being tear gassed, you know, lining up to buy fishbowl noodles or sandwiches for their lunch on their lunch break. You know, tear gas was being used, you know, some weekends the police were firing, you know, thousands of rounds of tear gas. It was just becoming something that was, you know, being used almost every weekend on the streets of Hong Kong, you know, in a way which goes, you know, violates UN conventions on the use of chemical weapons.
I want to show a news story from Sky News about the 2019 protests so people can have their memories refreshed about what the world saw.
In the city's streets, thousands clash with police. Umbrellas and bottles versus shields and batons. Through clouds of tear gas, they push forward.
Come on!
Tensions have been rising here for the last hour, and you can see the protesters have just broken through the barrier. They're surrounding the legislative building there, and some are trying to come down from the other end.
Their aim, to breach Parliament, to stop an extradition bill they believe puts their freedoms at risk from China.
Louise Lim, who are the protesters, or who were they by 2019?
That day, those protesters surrounding the legislature were mainly young people in their 20s and 30s, some even in their teens. But over time, the people who were protesting in 2019 encompassed all portions of society. I mean, you know, 2 million people were estimated to turn out at the biggest march. And, you know, I went to many of those marches. There were young people, there were old people, there were well-educated people, there were people with little education. You know, it was a real cross-section of society because so many people felt that their interests and their future was threatened by the changes that were proposed.
You say that at times the protesters themselves also became frighteningly violent. What's your view of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. The protesters, although they started off as peaceful, they became more radical and more violent as time went by. You know, the police, there was an incident when an old man was set on fire by protesters. There was an incident where people, you know, a journalist was treated in a very violent and frightening fashion by protesters, you know, and there were incidents where, you know, the use of sort of Molotov cocktails, flaming bows and arrows, you know, these were all commonly used by protesters. So, you know, I did not have sympathy for the use of violence by protesters. I was on the streets. I did witness how brutal the police behavior was, but I also, you know, sometimes found the behavior of protesters was quite scary as well. No, I was going to say, you know, at that time, Hong Kong streets did not feel at all safe in any way.
And you write that it culminated in the most terrifying day, October 1st, 2019, Chinese National Day, when police used live ammunition for the first time. You yourself felt endangered that day?
It was the most terrifying day for me, although there were days that were worse that followed. But for me, that was the most terrifying day because there was a lot of tear gas on the streets that day. And it was a day where I was wearing a press vest and a helmet with press written on it. And yet a policeman pulled a gun and stuck it right in my face, point blank range. And I was terrified. You know, I was with a group of reporters and he swiveled the gun, pointed it in each of our faces. And it was a really terrifying moment. But, you know, at that time, for reporters who were on the streets every day, you know, that was probably not a big deal for them because there was so much violence. You know, reporters were being arrested, you know, beaten up. All kinds of things were happening. But for me, it was a moment that was quite terrifying because for me, Hong Kong had always felt like such a safe place. It had always been a place where you could walk on the streets, even at night, alone, as a woman, and you never felt in any kind of danger. And those old certainties no longer existed. You know, walking on the street in the middle of the day felt terrifying.
What shut the protests down?
The protests, I mean, there were various reasons why they ended. One big reason was COVID. Once COVID began to pick up pace, there were new regulations which stopped people gathering in groups first of more than four and then in groups of more than two. So if you were standing on the street in a group of three people, you could be arrested. So COVID was a very big factor in shutting the protests down. But at the same time, there were other bits of legislation that were already being used to outlaw protests. People were being arrested for illegal assembly. Protests that had even had police permission were suddenly being declared illegal when they were had already started and were halfway through. So I think COVID was a useful pretext to stop people from protesting, and that process had already been underway for several months.
We have about 6 minutes left, and so many interesting ways to take the story. But I wanted to get one character, one person in, because he's a thread throughout your story. And that is a street artist that was nicknamed the King of Kowloon. And briefly, why did he become symbolic for you of Hong Kong?
I was fascinated by the King of Kowloon because he was such a feature of my childhood. So he was this extraordinary character, an elderly man who many people thought had mental health challenges. You know, when I was young, people used to say he was completely mad because he didn't wash and he smelt really bad. And he was disabled and, you know, he looked quite different. You know, he often was on the street sort of shirtless. And he believed that the peninsula of Kowloon had been stolen from his family by the British. And he spent decades painting graffiti on the walls of the city, claiming back this land that he thought was his. And, you know, the thing about his calligraphy was that it was really bad. He'd only had 2 years of schooling. His characters were all crooked. They weren't beautiful and balanced at all, but they were very distinctive. And whenever he painted on a wall, he would choose walls or spaces that belonged to the government. He was very contextual. So it was walls, slopes, electricity boxes, post boxes, lampposts, all government property, because he was claiming back his own land. And the government would send cleaners to wash off his words or to paint over them, and then he would come back and paint again on the same places. So, you know, in a way, he changed the cityscape by painting on it, and he became this sort of feature of the city, you know, this communal collective memory for Hong Kongers. And he became this iconic figure. You know, poets wrote poems to him, singers sang rap songs and jazz numbers to him. Artists did these sort of tributes to him, and he was in films, and he was in, like, adverts for cleaning products and Louis Vuitton handbags. And he became Hong Kong's most valuable artist, someone who actually represented Hong Kong at the Venice Biennale. So he was this really iconic, surprising figure, and I was fascinated by him because, to me, the themes that he was preoccupied were really central to Hong Kong, these themes of dispossession, territory, sovereignty, and loss. And yet he had been talking about them decades before other people, you know, so long ago that people thought he was mad. And, you know, when I went to interview people about him, you know, they would say things like, oh, maybe he was a shaman, you know, only when you go mad can you see the truth. And, you know, maybe he was a prophet. And so I was just very fascinated by him as a character.
We have just about 2 minutes left in closing. So you titled your book Indelible City, and you end the book with words of hope that Hong Kong will see the light again. What are your aspirations for Hong Kong?
At the moment, it is hard to be optimistic about Hong Kong's future just because of this type of clampdown has been so, the suppression has been so hard and so fast. But my hopes for Hong Kong lie in Hong Kong's people. Hong Kong's people are very resourceful. They're very determined. And like the King of Kowloon, they're very principled. You know, even like him, they believe that even if they don't think something will necessarily succeed, if it's a matter of principle, they will stick to it no matter what. So, you know, we're seeing very large numbers of Hong Kongers leaving Hong Kong and settling overseas. And, you know, I think the signs of optimism for Hong Kong are that it has, you know, it has raised these people with such a strong sense of morality and justice, and that cannot be stamped out. You know, these are people who would rather leave a place than be have their thoughts dictated, be told how to live. And I think that's an incredibly powerful thing. And, you know, to me, that's a measure of Hong Kong's indelibility as well. It lies in its people and their beliefs.
Louisa Lim is a journalist, and she's the author of a new book titled Indelible City, Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong, joining us from her home now in Melbourne, Australia. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to C-SPAN's Q&A, and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts so you'll never miss an episode. And while you're there, please take a minute to rate and review us. You can also send us an email about Q&A at podcasts@c-span.org. Send me your questions, your comments, or ideas. Your feedback is welcome.